01-0826-CR, State versus Jimmy Davison. Representing the state, Diane M. Welsh.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General Diane Welsh, representing the state of Wisconsin. As the petitioner in this case, the state respectfully asks this court to reverse the published opinion of the Court of Appeals and affirm the judgment of conviction entered in the circuit court. The state asks this court to clarify the analysis used to evaluate claims of multiplicity, to strengthen the guilty plea waiver rule, and to articulate the meaning of Section 939(66)(2)(m) of the Wisconsin statutes.
Do you want that in all in one opinion?
Yes, please.
Okay, just asking.
We need a little help here. To begin, I will discuss the need to clarify multiplicity analysis using the flowchart I sent to the court this week. If anyone needs additional copies, I have them with me.
This flowchart just struck a note of familiarity, as if I had seen it before. Has the state presented a similar flowchart in double jeopardy before?
Not that
I know
I'm,
you keep old briefs.
Not that I'm aware of. I think this was our first.
Before your time.
That was right.
I think this is our first attempt to put it in visual form. We've argued this, advanced this argument in the Court of Appeals before, but I think without visual aids. And I think this is the first time we've had the opportunity to advance it here.
Well, maybe all concentric circles look alike to me.
That's true. So, to highlight the need for clarification of what multiplicity analysis is in Wisconsin, I'll use my own brief to this court as an example. On page 15 of this brief, I quote an excerpt from this court's decision in State versus Trowitzki, which in turn relied on State versus Anderson. And in that excerpt, it indicates that if the offenses are identical in law and fact, then they are multiplicitous and therefore in violation of the double jeopardy clauses. This is an incomplete statement of the law. They're only multiplicitous and in violation of the double jeopardy clauses if the legislature did not intend to permit multiple convictions or multiple punishments for the two different convictions. So, for instance, convictions can be the same in fact and law and still be permissible and not violate double jeopardy.
Counsel, I know that's your argument in your brief, and yet I find, and perhaps that's why you started out, and well you did, by the need to clarify, because we have cases that say differently than what you're saying. We have cases that say what you're saying. I mean, there's, it seems to me that that we do need some clarifying here. Let me ask a question. Do you think it's all that clear-cut what you have just espoused as being the rule of law here in Wisconsin?
I think the federal constitutional law is clear in terms of what creates a double jeopardy violation when we're looking at multiple convictions or multiple punishment for one offense. And it's clear that the double jeopardy clause only comes into play if we're really looking at one offense, and for federal constitutional purposes, one offense means an offense which is the same in fact and law under Blockberger. So that part, the double jeopardy analysis, is clear. The multiplicity analysis in Wisconsin is less clear.
What about the multiplicity analysis federally? I went back and read Missouri v. Hunter several times. Maybe I didn't read the right case, but it's not clear to me under Missouri v. Hunter what they're saying. Is it clear to you?
I think what they were saying in Missouri versus Hunter is that even if you have an offense which is the same in fact and law as the Missouri courts construed their statutes to be, that it still may be permissible to punish twice or to have two convictions if that's what the legislature intended. I mean,
right.
That's,
And it doesn't matter, really, whether it's the same or not under Blackburger, because they cite Abernaz, isn't it Abernaz, or is it Whalen? I think it's in Abernaz, where they concluded that these two statutes, that was a federal case, two statutes didn't prescribe the same offense, because they didn't require proof that the other does not, and that it then says we might well have stopped at that point, right? Mm-hmm. That's what I think you would say under double jeopardy. But then they go on and say we might well have stopped at that point and upheld the petitioner's cumulative punishments under the challenge statutes, since cumulative punishment can presumptively be assessed after conviction for two offenses that are not the same. They go on to say, however, we went on to state that because the Blackburger test is a rule of statutory construction, and because it serves as a means of discerning congressional purpose, the rule should not be controlling where, for example, there is a clear indication of contrary legislative intent. Then they keep going on and on and on. And in a number of places here, they seem to say, hey, it's all legislative intent. The legislature intended double punishment in a single prosecution. That's all we're talking about, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We're not talking about acquittals, and we're not talking about anything else, just a single prosecution. Went on to say it's all legislative intent.
Right, and I think Albernaz was a District of Columbia case, if I recall correctly.
Well, it's a U.S. Supreme Court case.
Right, but involving statutes in the District of Columbia, so they were again looking at what Congress intended, so they had an obligation to construe what Congress intended in the statute to determine whether the multiple convictions were lawful. So in addition to not just looking at whether they violated the Double Jeopardy Clause of the Constitution, but were they lawful under federal statutes.
No, but they don't distinguish it that way.
They don't distinguish.
In Missouri v. Hunter. They just treat all these cases the same, whether the same offense, another offense. So I don't know what the rule is federally. Do you have a clearer case than Missouri v. Hunter?
I don't think so. And I think we need to look at first principles and look at the language of the Fifth Amendment to determine what double jeopardy precludes.
Counsel?
Yes.
No, go ahead. Have you finished?
No, I do not think there are clear-cut cases that demonstrate the point that I'm trying to advance here, that we're, separate out the difference between multiplicity analysis based on statutory claims and double jeopardy. I'll note, though, that federal cases, when they're discussing multiplicity, they're often looking at one offense or one act, and the definition that Blacks uses for multiplicity is parsing one offense into multiple charges or
convictions. It doesn't even matter. They shouldn't even bother. It's sort of like Strickland. Why bother with the first prong when you can get it on the second, right? I mean, the same elements, same law, that's maybe a little tougher. Mm-hmm. But a congressional intent, a legislative intent as to whether they include double punishment, that's not hard. And I bet that's what many of the cases do.
I think so. And I think what's important is to look at the issue that there are times when the legislature wants to preclude conviction for different acts, multiple convictions for more than one actual act. And the legislature has the authority to do that.
Let's remember, we're only talking about single prosecution.
Right, in a single prosecution, yes. And so even if we've evaluated that it's not the same offense, it's not the same in law, not the same in fact, the state courts still have an obligation to determine if the multiple prosecutions are lawful, and that's looking at state law and what our legislature means and if the prosecution's permissible. So under Albernaz, for instance, the Supreme Court was looking at whether Congress meant to permit multiple prosecutions for what may have been the same offense, but actually were different acts that constitute the offenses.
Now, except for the waiver issue, does it matter? Does your chart matter?
I think in terms of being consistent with federal constitutional law, it matters.
Well, we just decided that we can't. You don't have anything better than Missouri v. Hunter. Missouri v. Hunter is a little confused mm-hmm. and confusing.
But I can't think of any U.S. Supreme Court case where they held multiple convictions for multiple offenses to violate double jeopardy.
Well, they won't, because they're going to look to the intent, and the intent is going to say aye or nay, and that's going to be the end of it.
And they're going to look to the language of the Fifth Amendment, which talks about multiple...
Okay, but where does it matter whether it's multiplicity or double jeopardy except in waiver? I mean, I don't know. That's why I'm asking you. Now, you're making this point because you want this waived.
Right. And we're making the point to clarify, you know, double jeopardy law.
I know. To clarify for no ultimate goal is it's not worth the effort because the windup is the same.
Right.
You get the two prongs. The defendant is in or out. The state is in and out. Mm-hmm. It's clear enough.
Okay. And it is also important to strengthen the guilty plea waiver rule. You know, when we enter into plea negotiations with defendants, the state wants to be able to rely on the validity of this negotiated plea agreement.
That was my question. In discussing basically the guilty plea waiver rule here, and of course, opposing counsel says, well, it doesn't apply here. But your argument seems to be, well, you need some certainty. You need to rely on this. That is factually here, you'd be going back about 5 years.
Yes.
And what impact that would have on even retrying this case. Just talk about the waiver rule just for a little bit on why you think it definitely should apply here.
Well, because the guilty plea waiver rule applies to waive any claim that was apparent before entering the guilty plea except claims of double jeopardy. So because we don't believe this is a double jeopardy claim, we believe it should apply to protect the interests of the victims, the witnesses, for the efficient administration of justice in our courts. You know, it's difficult to go back and try a case 2 years, 3 years, or 5 years in this case later. You know, yes, we might go back and be able to renegotiate the plea or have one charge dismissed under Robinson, but the state is definitely at a disadvantage given the timing of this. And the defendant has another option here. The defendant could have but did not petition for leave to appeal. When the trial court denied his motion to dismiss a charge as multiplicitous, he could have petitioned the Court of Appeals to review this claim. That would have permitted for timely review of this claim so that the state wouldn't be in the petition now to have to consider retrying the case 5 years later. You know, this court has directed that, you know, to the extent that this is viewed as a double jeopardy claim, this court has directed that there should be expedited review of those claims. You know, even if it's not a double jeopardy claim, some of the same interests are affected in a multiplicity claim that's based on a statutory interpretation, so that should still influence the Court of Appeals to grant petitions when a multiplicity claim is raised. So the defendant's not left without a more timely and appropriate remedy. He's not stuck with the trial court's decision and then, you know, having to go to trial if he wants to preserve these claims. He can, you know, advance the claims before trial. And then both parties will negotiate and enter the plea, you know, knowing full well what the law is. I mean, here the trial court ruled on this. The state had a right to rely on the validity of the trial court's ruling that these were permissible charges under 939-662M.
The defendant here says that what you say is about the policy arguments here is good, but it doesn't apply in this case because all you have to do is knock out this one charge. You're left with two. The maximum sentences for those two either equal or exceed what the state asked for. So you still got a lot of years in there that you can clip in this particular case.
Well, and that we can get a good result in this particular case shouldn't drive the rule. And through, you know, by bringing the petition and having this court review the case, we really want to clarify the law. You know, there are many cases, as my opponent points out, where the Court of Appeals and this court have reviewed these claims despite what appears to be waiver. You know, is there a you know, does this category of cases fall within the waiver rule or not? And so we're really seeking to have this court clarify the rule on a general basis. You know, our interest in applying it in this case is, you know, is lesser, a lesser interest.
Now, if the legislation here does not allow multiple punishments, and if the court gives multiple punishments, that is a violation of due process, I assume.
Yes.
Is that right? If this is a double federal double jeopardy claim, right, it comes under a violation of due process, 14th Amendment.
Yes.
So what you're asking the court to say is a violation of the 14th Amendment due process because of double jeopardy is waived, but a violation of 14th Amendment due process because of there's punishment contrary to a statute is not waived.
Just the opposite. That the due process violation is waived and the double jeopardy claim is not waived.
But they're both due process arguments.
Right. They have both have due process implications.
And that's what the court said. That's what you're asking the court to do.
Yes. And, you know, and in any case, you know, the rule of waiver is one of administration and not of power. So in a case where a manifest injustice is created, the court can elect to review the claim despite waiver. You know, and for some of the same reasons that, you know, there's not, the defendant views that there's not a great injustice here, you know, perhaps whether it's reviewed or not, maybe doesn't make a big difference. I mean, it argues both ways between whether the court should have elected to review it or not. The Court of Appeals in this case, I'll note, did not view that it was, you know, it viewed that it had to review the claim because it implicated double jeopardy. So it's not a case where it was exercising its discretion based on its view that it either could or it could choose to review the claim or not. You know, it viewed that any claim of multiplicity necessarily implicates double jeopardy, so it necessarily reviewed the claim. So it wasn't a case where the Court of Appeals considered the value of reviewing this claim despite waiver.
The defendant here did make an objection.
Yes.
On double jeopardy grounds.
Yes.
So why do you think it's waived?
He pled guilty to those two counts. So any objections or motions that a defendant files prior to pleading guilty, unless it's a motion for suppression, and that the motion for suppression is different because the legislature has so ruled that it's different, but any prior motions that he's lost or won or whatever, all of those claims go away by pleading guilty. And had he objected to pleading guilty to those two claims, there were other counts that the state could have substituted for these counts.
But did the trial court err in not granting his motion before he pled?
No, and that's based on our analysis of Section 93966 sub 2M. And in this case, my opponent argues that because the language appears to be plain, we don't look at any other factors. That analysis is not consistent with the analysis set forth in Anderson, Grayson, Tappa, and other multiplicity cases where this court has established that there are four factors that this court looks at to determine what the legislature intended, whether they intended multiple punishments or not. So we look at the language of the statute. We look at the appropriateness of multiple punishments. We look at the legislative history and context, and we look at the type of conduct which is prescribed. And although it's the defendant's burden in this case to show a clear legislative intent not to permit multiple punishment, the Court of Appeals didn't apply that standard. Instead, it looked at the language of the statute and said because there was an opposite legislative intent to show that the legislature intended multiple punishment, that the state lost the argument and, you know, multiple punishments were not permissible. So I I think the Court of Appeals...
Isn't that what Albert Ness said? That you have to have a clear indication of contrary legislative intent, and isn't the language of the statute clear indication of contrary legislative intent?
The language can be a clear indication of legislative intent, true. But then under Grayson and Tappa and Anderson, we're not precluded from looking beyond the language of the statute. We look at the intent of, you know, the purpose of the statute, the legislative history and context. And I think when you consider those factors, the state's argument that the legislature really did intend to permit multiple punishment becomes stronger. When you look, 939662M was drafted in response to this court's decision in State versus Richards. The concern in Richards only dealt with 940.19. It didn't deal with the special circumstances under which batteries are committed under 940.20. So there's no reason to believe that when 939662M was drafted, it meant to preclude prosecution under both of the different sections.
I'm sorry, I just don't remember the other cases well enough, but was it plain language in any of those as plain as this one?
Well,
that we were dealing with?
In State versus Multaylor, which this court heard last term, it thought the language was very clear, but then it also looked at the fourth factor. You know, because which was the defendant asked the court to look at the fourth factor, so it didn't stop its analysis, you know, at the plain language. So it's, and none of those decisions does the court indicate, you know, the typical rule of statutory construction, which is, you know, stop at the plain language if the language is unambiguous. And I think it's helpful because if you look at the purpose of 940.20, you know, that was to cause increased punishments under special circumstances. Under the Court of Appeals interpretation, if a prisoner chooses to commit aggravated battery, he is subjected to no harsher punishment than a citizen who commits aggravated battery because any special circumstances, you know, are negated because of the court's interpretation that multiple punishments aren't permissible. Similarly, if a prisoner commits simple battery, he has a free pass to go on and, you know, commit aggravated battery because he will be punished the same whether he commits simple battery or aggravated battery.
Well, Grayson says there's no express indication of legislative intent as to the allowable unit of prosecution in 948.22. The state concedes that the statute is ambiguous. Therefore, we're going to look at the other factors.
Right.
Do you think the plain language here is ambiguous?
I think it is. I think that's what led the prosecutor to charge both statutes, charge counts under both statutes, led the trial court to believe that it's permissible to charge under both statutes, and, you know, so it's obviously there's some ambiguity in the language. So I think it is, you know, whichever rules of statutory construction or factors you look at, I think there is some ambiguity in the statute.
Counsel, twice in your brief you cite the case of State versus Vassos. And that case involved successive prosecutions for batteries. You cited on pages 18 and 21 of your brief. That, and it also discussed 939.66. That case was kind of interesting because there was a concurring opinion that had four justices sign on to it. And that opinion, the concurring opinion with the four justices signing on to it, seems to speak to this issue today before the court. In paragraphs 36 and 37, it indicates that this court and the legislature have acknowledged the imperfections in the same elements test. And it goes on to note in paragraph 36, the legislature in turn has also partially abandoned the same elements test for purposes of cases involving multiple punishments for the same offenses under 939-66-2M, which is the one we're dealing with here today. Under that statute, a defendant cannot be convicted of both a battery and an equal or lesser battery, regardless of the particular elements existing for the count charged. It continues in paragraph 37. The legislature's action in enacting 939-66 protects defendants from multiple punishment for the same offense under the Double Jeopardy Clause. And then the sentence goes on. What do you deal with that? How do you deal with that opinion that has four justices?
In terms of characterizing it as a double jeopardy?
Yes, that's right. I mean, as I read that language, it says, hey, look, the courts and the legislature have recognized that for purposes of double jeopardy protection, the Blackburger test is inadequate. 939-66 legislatively recognized that and attempts to address it with regard to prosecutions for battery, and that the legislative action protects defendants from multiple punishments for the same offense under the Double Jeopardy Clause.
Well, you know, with all due respect to this court, it's the, you know, when the United States Supreme Court has created a rule of on a federal constitutional question, state courts are bound to follow it. So the federal courts are following the Blackburger test. The United States Supreme Court has said we look to Blackburger, and if we have the same offense, you know, only if there's the same offense does it violate double jeopardy. May I continue? So if this court can elect under its statutes to create a different test to determine whether it's lawful or unlawful, but I don't think the statutes can be rewrote to create a different constitutional test of federal constitutional law.
Thank you, Ms. Welsh. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Finley at Remington Center, representing Mr. Davison.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Jimmy Davison is in prison serving a sentence on a conviction that the legislature has said, as clearly as it can, cannot be imposed upon him. He's serving a sentence that's simply and plainly unlawful and beyond the power of the executive and the judicial branches to impose. The state's primary response to this situation is to attempt to insulate that illegality from appellate review. The state argues for creation of really new waiver law barring appellate review of multiplicity claims following a guilty plea. This diverts attention from the real issue in this case, and that is that the prosecutor's charging and dispositional decisions in this case contravened the clear mandates of the legislature. Now, if we could, let's take just a minute to take a look at what the state's world would look like if this court were to adopt the rule proposed by the state. Under that rule, the only double jeopardy or multiplicity claims that survive a guilty plea are those where the multiple convictions happen to violate the Blockburger elements only test. A test, by the way, that the United States Supreme Court has explained repeatedly is nothing more than a tool for determining legislative intent. Other claims where the legislature's intent may be even more clearly expressed, can't be reviewed. Now, in oral argument here today, the state has suggested, well, they can be reviewed if you file an interlocutory appeal. There are a couple of reasons why that's not a sufficient answer. Number one, of course, it's discretionary, and the Court of Appeals need not take those cases. But number two, an interlocutory appeal on a double punishment claim is premature. It's premature because at that point the defendant hasn't been convicted and punished of one crime, let alone two. And that's precisely what the United States Supreme Court was addressing in Ohio versus Johnson when it said we're not going to stop a state prosecution in its tracks on double punishment grounds, because that assumes that there will be multiple punishments, and we don't have any punishments yet. So the interlocutory appeal is not an adequate remedy.
Because you can have multiple charges.
You can have multiple charges.
Even if they are the same offense.
That's right, because what the double jeopardy protection against double punishments protects against is double punishments, not double prosecution.
And this court has said that, too.
That's right. This rule then creates an odd circumstance, the state's rule. The multiple punishments test involves two prongs. That is, the first prong is the Blockberger test, which is just one way of evaluating what the legislature intended. And the second prong, then, is to look at whether there are other clearly articulated expressions of legislative intent that override the presumption created by the Blockberger test. But if this court were to adopt the state's test, the state's rule here, courts in this case on appeal, after a guilty plea, would be required to consider prong one, but forbidden from considering prong two. Under the state's rule, the courts would review only half the analysis. In the state's rule, punishments that contravene clear legislative intent are not reviewable on appeal unless the defendant takes the case to trial. So the state's remedy when the defendant believes that the charges are multiplicitous is go to trial. But trial is not the proper remedy for charging and decisions and sentencing errors that have nothing to do with guilt or innocence. That's a highly inefficient, a waste of judicial resources to force a defendant to take his claim to trial when he doesn't claim to be innocent, simply in order to preserve his claim that the state never had the authority to hail him into court on both charges to begin with, or to punish him for both charges to begin with. And in fact, what I've just outlined is the very rationale that underlies the exception to the guilty plea waiver rule that applies to double jeopardy claims. It's not premised on some notion that the double jeopardy clause is a constitutional violation. We all know that there are many constitutional claims that are waived by a guilty plea. Rather, it's premised on the idea that a double jeopardy claim or a multiplicity claim hinges not at all on the question of guilt or innocence, and that's the issue that's resolved at trial, but rather on the state's authority to punish at all for the double jeopardy barred claim. Guilty pleas concede factual guilt. They make constitutional claims related to the truth-finding functions of a trial irrelevant, but a double jeopardy or multiplicity claim is different. It's a claim that the executive and judicial branches lack the authority to punish the defendant for a crime, even though he may be factually guilty. And so under those circumstances, there's no reason to treat the plea as a waiver of the claim. That's precisely the rationale that the United States Supreme Court employed in Mena versus New York, and that this court then adopted in State versus Morris.
Counsel?
Yes.
In response to a question that I asked regarding the Vassos opinion, and the language in that opinion that indicated that 939-66 was going beyond the Blockberger test to provide protection under double jeopardy. The response essentially was that the state cannot legislatively extend double jeopardy protection beyond Blockberger, as I understood the response, and I hopefully am correctly characterizing it. Can you respond to that, please?
Okay, I think if I understand correctly what you're saying and what I think I heard the state to say, correct me if I'm getting your point wrong, but I think what I heard the state saying was this court may have in fact held in Vassos, which I believe it did, as you correctly point out, that double jeopardy, that 939-66-2M defines what is the same offense, and that renders punishment a violation of the Double Jeopardy Clause, regardless of whether it violates Blockberger. What I think I heard the state say in response to that is, well, the court was wrong in that holding because this court can't say the Double Jeopardy Clause means more than the United States Supreme Court has said that it means. And I guess my response to that, if I'm tracking you correctly so far, I think my response to that is, where is the United States Supreme Court that says that's wrong? That holding in Vassos is entirely consistent and, in fact, much more consistent with the rationale and the logic and the reasoning of the United States Supreme Court opinions. It is precisely the outcome that I see in Missouri versus Hunter, for example, where the court says, yes, the Blockberger test is an important tool, but the reason it's important is because it helps us, it creates a presumption. It's a tool to legislative interpretation. It helps us understand what the legislature probably intended. But it's not the end of the analysis because ultimately the question is, what did the legislature intend? And so if the legislature intended to permit or prohibit multiple punishments contrary to what the Blockberger test would suggest, we're going to go with what the legislature actually intended, with those contrary and clear expressions of legislative intent. And then Missouri versus Hunter says, as do many other Supreme Court cases since then, they say the Double Jeopardy Clause does nothing more than prohibit more punishment than the legislature intended. And that's what Vassos says. That's the way I read it. That's what Vassos is all about. So I think Vassos is right on point in that language that you've cited, that it controls the situation, and it is entirely consistent with United States Supreme Court precedents. My first point is, though, that this doesn't really matter. Because whether it's double jeopardy or just multiplicity, the guilty plea waiver rule shouldn't apply in either event and never has applied under the decisions of this court.
Why not?
For the reasons that I outlined at the start, in that the rationale underlying the non-waiver rule for double jeopardy applies equally fully to multiplicity, even if they are separate doctrines, which I, of course, don't believe they are.
I guess on the concept that the state just doesn't have the power to prosecute.
That's right.
And that the defendant can't give it by a waiver.
That's very right. And that it makes no sense to make the defendant take his case to trial in order to vindicate a claim that has nothing to do with guilt or innocence, that has nothing to do with the issue that's going to be tried at a trial. That's a highly inefficient system, a gross waste of judicial resources to force people into trials when they don't claim to be innocent just so that they can raise on appeal a challenge to the state's authority to impose the punishment that the state seeks.
Do you think we should clarify the law by just saying if it's multiplicitous charges?
That's my first response.
Can't plead guilty to them.
Yes. The first and simplest route to resolving this is just simply to say whether it's double jeopardy or multiplicity, whether they're different or not, doesn't matter. You don't waive them by entering a plea of guilty. And, in fact, that is entirely consistent with what this court and the Court of Appeals have done time and time again with double jeopardy and multiplicity claims following guilty pleas. If the state's right, then this court was wrong in State versus Grayson. This court was wrong in State versus Lechner. This court was wrong in State versus Anderson. This court was wrong in State versus Morris. It was wrong in State versus Multaylor. Each one of those cases, it was a case in which there was a guilty plea, and yet this court considered both prongs of the multiplicity test. If the state's right, this court shouldn't have done that. At least unless it expressly said this issue is waived, but nonetheless, in the exercise of our discretion, we're considering the claim. But that's not what the court did. The court treated it. I'm sorry.
Other than waiver, is there any other place in the law that you can think of that it matters whether it's double jeopardy or multiplicity?
I do not know of any other difference. I don't know any place where it matters at all. I can't conceive of a situation in which it matters whether we label it double jeopardy or we label it multiplicity. No, I don't think it does matter. And I think that I guess leads me to my next point, which is even which is that, in fact, maybe it doesn't matter because they aren't different. In fact, multiplicity and double jeopardy are the same doctrine. To clarify what I mean by that, the state has presented a Venn diagram. I didn't prepare a Venn diagram, but I think I can describe an alternate one, maybe even show you one right here on the spot that describes what I think double jeopardy and multiplicity analysis really mean to one another. So if you'll indulge me just a minute here, my chart's much simpler, so I didn't have to prepare it in advance. But all that mine is a single circle. You divide that single circle into three pie pieces. Each of these pie pieces represents one of the interests protected by the double jeopardy clause. First, you have the interest against prosecution after acquittal. Second, you have the interest in barring prosecution after conviction. And third, you have the interest in barring multiple punishments for the same offense. This third pie piece is multiplicity. That's all it is. That's the analysis completely. The state would draw an overlapping circle here. It says this is multiplicity and it sort of intersects here. But in reality, multiplicity, and so in my brief I talk about multiplicity and double jeopardy being coterminous doctrines. I'm talking about coterminous in this segment of the double jeopardy clause.
Single prosecution.
Single prosecution, multiple punishments.
You want to submit that to the court, counsel?
If you want it.
I think I can duplicate it. I easily myself.
And again, the reason I say the multiplicity and double jeopardy are the same is simply because the United States Supreme Court, and now this court, has made very clear that the double jeopardy bar to multiple punishments, does nothing more than prohibit more punishment than the legislature intended. And under this, what Wisconsin has done is create two steps, two ways for evaluating what the legislature intended. Number one, in this segment here, you have the Blockburger test. But the U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly told us that's just a tool to aid in determining what the legislature intended. The second prong of the multiplicity test, all that does is say, well, maybe the Blockburger test presumption, and it is a presumption, this court has called it a presumption, I believe in Vassos it did in Durango, a presumption about what the legislature intended can be overcome by a clear expression of contrary legislative intent. That's the second prong. They both go to what the legislature intended, and that is the double jeopardy analysis for multiple punishments in a nutshell. Now, the state is right about one thing. Multiple punishments offend the double jeopardy clause only if they're applied to the same offense. But that's what the multiplicity test is designed to tell us. Was this the same offense or not? And that whether it's the same offense turns solely on what the legislature intended.
Well, but they're saying the same offense means Blackburn.
I understand that's what they're saying. And I think
they're saying it means both prongs.
That's right. If you even look at how this court has defined multiplicity, multiplicity is defined repeatedly in the decisions of this court as the charging of a single offense in more than one count. That's multiplicity. Both prongs look to, and so what we, when we talk about a single offense, we're not giving the Blockburger test some mystical, power to tell us what is a single offense. What's a single offense means nothing more than what did the legislature intend to be prosecuted or punished once, and what did it intend to be punished more than once. And that's, again, what I think Vassos is telling us, is that in 939-66, the legislature has told us that we look to two things. In some cases, we look to the Blockburger elements-only test, but in other kinds of situations, we look to what the legislature intended in 939-66 tells us that the legislature did not intend to permit multiple punishments for batteries. So the most the state can hang its hat on is some dicta in Grayson and Trowitzki. But I submit that dicta is just that, dicta, and it's incorrect. And other decisions of this court in holdings make that clear, that double jeopardy is implicated by both prongs of the multiplicity analysis, because double jeopardy is nothing more than a search into what the legislature intended.
Now, can you do better for us than Missouri v. Hunter, which I think is a little vague, or a lot vague on the edges, or other states where either they have accepted your tripartite circle or have taken the states? Now, you've got some discussions in your brief.
Yeah, I actually think Missouri versus Hunter is relatively clear on this. I agree that there is some ambiguity because they talk about the Blackburger test as establishing what is the same offense and then go on to look for legislative intent. But
they clearly have two prongs.
They do, and they
clearly ditch the second prong.
They don't, and they treat both prongs as part of the double jeopardy analysis. And there is, this is an issue that just doesn't come up very often, so there isn't a lot of case law that directly addresses what we're talking about here today, but there is a case from Texas, State versus Irvin, which is cited in the briefs, where they do hold precisely what I'm telling you, that a clear expression of legislative intent will render something a violation of the double jeopardy clause, even if it's not barred by the Blockberger test. And I think if you look at the cases that have come along since Missouri versus Hunter, they repeatedly talk in terms of the double jeopardy clause doing nothing more than prohibiting more punishment than the legislature intended. That's the clear theme, that's the clear thrust of it, and there's absolutely no basis in any of those cases for suggesting that a search for legislative intent outside the Blockberger test is somehow not part of the constitutional analysis.
Well, that still leaves you, even if we accept that, the concept that the legislature here intended to punish us.
Right. Now we get to the merits. To the merits of...
At last.
At last, yes. And on that, I don't know how the legislature could have made it any clearer than it did in 939.66(2)(m). That multiple punishments for multiple batteries are not permissible. Statute says clearly that an actor can be convicted of either the crime charge or an included crime, but not both, and an included crime includes a crime which is a less serious or equally serious type of battery than one charge. There's just no ambiguity there. You get one battery for one act, for one criminal episode. You get one battery. That's what the statute says. There's simply no ambiguity here. Now, the state suggests there's ambiguity because it's not clear whether this refers just to the batteries in Section 940.19 or whether also to the batteries in Section 940.20. Both of those statutes involve batteries, both use the term battery, and 939.66(2)(m) is not limited to either one of those sections by its terms. It doesn't say it only applies to Section 940.19. It doesn't say this applies to anything.
says it applies to batteries. Surely, if the legislature meant for it to apply only to batteries under 940.19, it would have said so, or it would have put this provision in 940.19. It didn't do any of that. And we can see by looking at 939.66 that the legislature knew how to limit its scope when it wanted to. And this is a point that's not made in the briefs, but if you look at the other subsections of 939.66, there are multiple examples of cases in which the legislature did write into the statute specific statutes to which it applied. For example, 939.66 sub 2R says its bar against multiple punishments applies only to violations of section 943.23, which is various levels, various degrees of operating a vehicle without owner's consent. 939.66 sub 4M says it applies, that subsection applies only to 948.22 sub 2 and sub 3, which are different degrees of failure to pay child support. 939.66 sub 6 says it applies, that subsection applies only to violations of section 940.285, which is abuse of vulnerable adults, when the crime charged is a battery under 940.19 sub 2 through 6 or other listed. So even in that subsection, they actually do limit it to a particular type of battery. So when you go up and you look at 939.66 2M and it says batteries broadly and doesn't limit it to any particular subsection, that seems to me is very telling, that the legislature didn't intend to limit that.
How many statutes include the word battery? Did you do a check on that?
I have not counted them up, I'm sorry. I don't know the answer to that right off.
I was curious to see if they all fit.
If they all...
939.66 2M.
If they are batteries... And you know, here's another indication that all the batteries share a common element, that they're all the same, essentially the same crime, that is causing physical harm to another person. If they are batteries, the statute by its terms applies to them.
What about the other parts of the test, the legislative history, the nature of the prescribed conduct, and the appropriateness of multiple punishments?
Yeah, I do think the accepted... I do think it's inappropriate to go beyond the plain language in this instance, because the plain language is so clear and it's an accepted rule of statutory construction that the courts don't look beyond that language when it is so clear.
Not in this context, though.
Well, it has, the courts have looked beyond that, beyond the plain language. That's true. But I think that the Chief Justice is right, if I'm reading her correctly, in suggesting that that's because in those cases the language wasn't as clear as this. But even if you do look beyond the plain language of the statute, there's still no ambiguity created here whatsoever.
Well, it's not a matter of creating ambiguity. It's not that sort of a test as to whether the statute is ambiguous or unambiguous. The case law provides that the way the presumption is overcome is by a clear indication of legislative intent to the contrary, and that is determined by reference to the language of the statute, the legislative history, the nature of the prescribed conduct, and the appropriateness of multiple punishments. It's a different sort of an inquiry.
And I would respond that I don't think there's anything in the legislative history or any of the other factors you've suggested that indicates even a faint legislative intent, let alone a clear legislative intent, to limit the reach of 939.66 sub 2M. If you look at the statutory history, for example, I don't quarrel with the state's suggestion that 939.66 2M was adopted in response to State versus Richards. I don't quarrel with the fact that State versus Richards dealt with only the batteries in 940.19. But just because this court was limited to the case before it, which was a 940.19 case, doesn't mean at all that the legislature was similarly limited when it adopted language, a statute with very broad language that applies generally to the entire criminal code. And in fact, the legislative history suggests the contrary, because the first draft of the revision adopted in response to Richards was one that simply changed the elements of section 940.19 batteries so that those batteries would become lesser included offenses. But the legislature ultimately rejected that approach and adopted the much broader response of adopting 93966 sub 2M, indicating they meant to make a broader reaching response to the problem.
Well, isn't that not quite the right focus, though? Shouldn't we be looking in the legislative history and in these other parts of the test for some indication that the legislature intended to prohibit multiple punishments for special purposes battery and general battery? I think it's a matter of how you frame the question here. If we're looking for legislative history that suggests that the legislature intended to preclude multiple punishments for special purposes battery and general battery, under the general battery statute, I don't think there's anything in the legislative history that shows the legislature intended to preclude a double prosecution, as it were.
Assuming that's the right framework, I think there is clear legislative intent, and which is what I just described to you, that the legislature considered an approach that would limit the applicability of 93966, I'm sorry, wouldn't apply to 93966 at all, but that would limit the applicability of the revision, the double jeopardy bar, simply to 940.19, and it rejected that approach. It rejected the approach of simply amending the elements of 940.19 and instead more broadly adopted 93966 sub 2M, which says you can't have multiple battery convictions, and that applies generally broadly across the board to the entire criminal code. I don't know how you can get a clearer statement of legislative intent and a clearer expression of legislative history than that. Boy, if you were to challenge a legislator to come up with something more clear than that, I think they'd be hard-pressed. And the state also suggests that that interpreting 93966 sub 2M to apply to all batteries defeats the deterrent effect of the special circumstances batteries. But that you can only reach that conclusion if you ignore the fact that simple battery and intermediate battery under 940.19 are a Class A misdemeanor and a Class E felony, whereas battery by a prisoner is a Class D felony. So it certainly has tremendous deterrent effect in those situations because it does make every battery committed by a prisoner a Class D felony, regardless of the degree of harm caused by the perpetrator. So it seems to me that all of these factors actually support the clear language of the statute as well. Before I stop, I think I have a minute or two here left. Let me, if I could, just go back to one other point that was raised in the state's reply brief that I think warrants some brief response here. And that is, the state suggests that Mr. Davison shouldn't be permitted to raise this claim on appeal now because he's somehow sandbagging. And I have to strongly reject that suggestion. Sandbagging is a concern when a litigant sits on a claim, doesn't raise it in hopes of sneaking it in at some point later in the process. Mr. Davison didn't sit on his claim. He raised his claim. He filed a motion to dismiss the double jeopardy barred counts.
I think the sandbagging argument goes to the plea negotiation.
I understand that, but I think the state has it exactly backwards. It's the state that sandbagged in this case because Mr. Davison was under no obligation, under controlling case law, he was under no obligation to say one word about this in the guilty plea. State versus Hubbard made it very clear at the time, and it's still good law, that it's the state's burden if they want to bar a double jeopardy or multiplicity claim. It's the state's burden to put that waiver expressly into the plea agreement. The state knew that. It was the governing law at the time. The state said not one word about it at the plea hearing. The state didn't make that an element of the plea bargain. And now, having sat on that claim, that waiver claim, the state tries to use it as a weapon to prohibit Mr. Davison from getting review of the claim that he did everything the law required of him to preserve for purposes of appeal. So,
what's your authority for the premise that it's the state's burden to put that provision in the plea agreement?
State versus Hubbard. Court of Appeals decision states very clearly that a plea bargain does not waive a multiple punishments claim and that if the state wants that claim to be waived, the state can put it into the plea bargain to bar review under that situation. But failing to write a waiver into the plea bargain, the claim is not waived. That's the holding in State versus Hubbard. That's what the parties were entitled to rely upon at the time that they went through the trial court proceedings in this case. So, for these reasons, we'd ask that this court affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals holding that the punishment for both aggravated battery and battery by a prisoner based on the same set of circumstances violates double jeopardy and multiplicity principles and is not waived by the guilty plea.
What does it do? Go back for resentencing?
What the Court of Appeals ordered was that the case be remanded for the trial court to determine an appropriate remedy, recognizing that in State versus Robinson, this court had held that ordinarily the appropriate remedy under these circumstances is to vacate the plea. But Robinson also recognized that that's the ordinary remedy, not the required remedy in every circumstance. And the court
agree with that remand?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think certainly this court could determine a different remedy, but I think that strikes me as an appropriate result, is to send it back. Mr. Davison is not asking for plea withdrawal. He is asking to send it back for resentencing on the two remaining counts. And he thinks that there's good reason to do that, including the fact that, as you pointed out, that he's still facing 22 years in prison on the two remaining counts. That's precisely what the state requested in this case, was 22 years in prison. He actually got 16 years in prison. So he's not, even if this case goes back to resentencing on the two counts, he's not going to get an automatic undeserved windfall as a result of this litigation. The trial court will have the discretion to construct an appropriate sentence, certainly within the limits of what the state had asked for and what it gave the first time around. Thank you.
Mr. Kinley, Ms. Welsh.
I guess I'll start with my Venn diagram, which is a point that opposing counsel brought up. And I think what I want to discuss is that in looking at the two tracks, or what the state views as the two tracks of the multiplicity analysis, the first is, you know, what does the Constitution allow? And then the second is, beyond that, what does the state allow? And so the second prong takes into account that the legislature or state courts can go beyond what the federal constitution permits. So that allows for if under 939.66, the legislature wants to build in extra protections against prosecution for more than one offense, it can do so as by creating legislative language that does that. Like, for instance, in Richards, this court held that it had to find that what logically seemed to be a lesser-included offense was not a lesser-included offense by applying the Blockberger elements-only test. Therefore, it suggests to the legislature that if it wanted to fix this apparent problem, it could craft language to do so. And the legislature looked at the two alternatives that this court advanced and considered one and then later went on to the next. It adopted language that this court suggested. And when this court suggested the language about adding a subsection under 939.66, it did not suggest that this would also cover all other batteries that are mentioned elsewhere in the statutes. You know, it advanced that solution as a remedy to fix the problem that was created by 940.19. So I think in terms of the legislature rejecting one approach and then taking a broader approach wasn't necessarily electing to take an approach that incorporated all batteries. So in terms of that, the legislature and our courts can provide greater protections, you know, by statute or by interpreting our statutes in a manner. I think that's where I look at our Venn diagram in terms of there are situations where the legislature can say it's impermissible to convict for different offenses, and therefore they wouldn't violate double jeopardy, but they would violate our statutes. And so those would fit into what's loosely called multiplicity, where it's more punishments or more convictions than the legislature intends.
Counsel, your opposing counsel defines, and several times in brief in an oral argument today, defines the double jeopardy bar as follows, that it prevents sanctions beyond what the legislature intended.
I think that proves too much. If that's really what it, if that's true, then any time a court violates or sentences and violates over and above what the legislature has authorized, that would be a double jeopardy violation, and that's not true.
It would be a due process violation?
Yes, it's a due process violation. So using that statement to mean that goes too far, I think in the cases where the court has said it, generally it's applied it to determine did the legislature intend multiple punishments for the same offense versus did the legislature intend to limit punishments for more than one offense. And I think that's where we need to look not to dicta of this state court, but rely on the first principles of our United States Constitution and constitutional law. So the state's argument is not resting on dicta. It's resting on the first principles.
Where do you get the first principle?
From the language of the Fifth Amendment, where, you know, we're looking at are we punishing or, you know, punishing or subjecting to double jeopardy for the same offense. Once we determine that we're not talking about the same offense...
The Blockberger test isn't in the Constitution.
Correct.
You can just as easily interpret that Constitution to say same offense means whatever Congress or the state legislature says it means. Mm-hmm. Legislative intent, right?
Right. And we have...
And now we're confused because of Missouri versus Hunter has both in it.
Mm-hmm. But in here, I think it's important that in this case... You know, we're talking about offenses that aren't the same in law or in fact. You know, we're talking about multiple volitional acts, you know, that could have created numerous charges under either 940-19 or 940-20. So, I mean, I think it's important that, you know, we're not looking at the same offense in this case.
So maybe the state erred in charging one offense, or here two, instead of 10 for every blow struck.
Mm-hmm.
Right, under Robbie.
Right. I think that that's possible. And in here, the state was never required to parse out the complaint or, you know, into various the count three and count four because it didn't proceed to trial and jury instructions. You know, but as an alternative basis for affirming the trial court's decision, this court can do that under State versus McKinney and look at that there are various separate volitional acts engaged in, and even if 939-662M would preclude prosecution for the same act, it wouldn't preclude it for the various acts that Mr. Davison committed.
Even without a complaint or information, do you think that gives notice to what he pled? You're going to change that now?
I think under United States versus Broci, you know, to the extent that he's arguing that there's not a factual basis to support both charges, that type of a claim is forfeited by the pleas of guilty. Thank you.
Do you know, did you go through the statute and look at all the places battery appears? And
outside of 940, 19, and 20.
I didn't know whether or not there were any other provisions that you didn't think were covered under 2.
Would you like me to research
no,
that?
No, I don't. I can do it myself. Thank you. That concludes the hearing in 01-0826 CR State.